enemy killed, while government forces suffered light casualties. Communist gunners fired mortars and rockets against 18 locations overnight, causing damage to South Vietnamese installations. A United States Marine transport helicopter was shot down near Da Nang. 9 South Vietnamese soldiers died, and 8 others were injured. A report from Voice of America correspondent Wayne Hyatt in Saigon says the entire cabinet of South Vietnam's Premier Tran Van Hung has submitted its resignation to facilitate the setting up of a new administration. A government spokesman said the premier held a special session Monday morning and accepted the resignations of all of his ministers. However, the cabinet ministers will stay on the job until Premier Hung has chosen their replacements. Egyptian and Israeli fighter planes attacked each other's ground positions across the Suez Canal yesterday for the first time since the 1967 war. Egypt said it knocked down 19 Israeli jets. Israel admitted losing 2 planes and said it shot down 5 Egyptian aircraft. The battle was touched off by an Israeli commando raid earlier across the canal on an Egyptian fortress. Israel said it held the fort for an hour, but Egypt said it repulsed the Israelis. Casualty reports conflict. Both sides see the fighting as a serious escalation. Reuters news agency quotes Israeli officials in Tel Aviv as saying the ceasefire between Israel and Egypt has become fiction. America's former Vice President Hubert Humphrey met with Premier Alexei Kosygin and said the Soviet leader told him the Soviet government is looking forward to cooperation with the United States. Mr. Humphrey, who is touring the Soviet Union as a private citizen, met for 2.5 hours with the Kremlin leader in Moscow. The United States Senate will resume debate Tuesday on the controversial anti-ballistic missile proposal. The final week of debate will begin with the Senate still divided on the Nixon administration's proposal to deploy the defensive system designed to protect missile bases located in the United States. Democratic Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, the leader of the opposition forces, maintains that the vote will be extremely close, with the outcome in doubt until the final vote. Supporters of the system, called Safeguard, say it is necessary to protect America's missile force in the 1970s. The Council of the Organization of American States met in informal secret sessions early today in Washington. It meets again later today to consider reports from an OAS commission that is trying to enforce a ceasefire between El Salvador and Honduras. El Salvador has insisted that its troops will not leave Honduras until there are satisfactory guarantees for its people in Honduras. El Salvador also has accused Honduras of violating the OAS ceasefire that began Friday night. Honduras has denied the charge. America's air traffic controllers reportedly are preparing resignations in sufficient numbers to bring about a massive tie-up of air traffic at the nation's airports after Apollo 11 splashes down. Spokesmen for the controllers' union say at least one half of the union's more than 7,000 members have indicated they will resign over a Federal Aviation Agency threat. They predict it will disrupt domestic and international flights. The FAA announced last week it plans to discipline about 400 controllers who staged a work slowdown last month, protesting a lack of skilled controllers and equipment. That's the news from the Voice of America newsroom. This is Bob White reporting.
You're listening to the Voice of America's continuing coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. And now we go to Houston for a status report from VOA's Jim Miller.
Mission Control here in Houston says that all is going very well. Both with astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin on the lunar surface, they have been there now for almost 17 hours, 16 hours, 52 minutes to be exact, and with Mike Collins, who is piloting, except that he is asleep right now and in a very sound sleep, according to the telemetry being received from Columbia, orbiting about the moon. In about 1 hour and a half from now, at about 1442 Greenwich time, the two astronauts on the lunar surface are going to be awakened, as will Mike Collins up in Columbia, and their first duties then will be to begin a two-hour inspection and the preparation of the Eagle lunar module for ascent from the lunar surface. That is scheduled to come at 1755 Greenwich time, when they will fire the ascent rocket and head up into a communal orbit with the Columbia spacecraft. Shortly before 21 hours Greenwich time, the redocking is scheduled, and that will rejoin the lunar module with the command module, and then they will prepare for their long trip back to the Earth. Otherwise, all is going well. Armstrong has not slept as well, perhaps, as they had hoped, probably exhilarated by his experience of being the first man to walk upon the lunar surface. The telemetry from his spacesuit indicates that he has been at best dozing and certainly has not been in a deep sleep such as that being enjoyed by Mike Collins up in Columbia. There's no way to check on the condition or just the exact activity of Buzz Aldrin because his suit is not instrumented. So all goes well with the Apollo mission. About an hour and a half left before the astronauts get up in the Eagle lunar module and begin preparing for that very critical phase of this mission, which will be leaving the lunar surface. That's the situation in Houston. Now back to Washington.
The first American to fly an orbital mission into outer space was Colonel John Glenn in the Mercury capsule Friendship 7 on February 20th, 1962. Colonel Glenn has since retired from the astronaut program, but he's never lost his enthusiasm for the space program. This was demonstrated in a conversation heard earlier when Voice of America's Albert Johnson contacted Colonel Glenn by telephone at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. Colonel Glenn, it's a true pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm glad to be able to participate and say hello again to so many people all over the world through the Voice of America.
Well, what was your reaction when you heard that announcement today? The Eagle has landed. How did you, as a former astronaut, feel?
Well, that was great. I think that whole approach to the landing, just that must rank right up with the greatest experiences that man has ever had, obviously. And that final approach where they were coming down and where Buzz Aldrin was calling off the altitudes one after the other and their drift rate across the lunar surface as they were making the approach for a landing, that just had to be, there just aren't words to describe how we felt on that one and how everyone that was sharing this all over the world and other nations too felt right along with us, I know.
What did you do at that time?
Well,
did you shout or what?
No, I think along with everyone else here in the center, I was just so intent on what was going on that you didn't really have time to think of anything else except just sort of concentrating on what the fellows were doing up there in the approach for landing.
Well, Colonel Glenn, perhaps you have some personal pangs of regret. If it hadn't been for a fall in a bathroom, it might be that perhaps you would have been one of the astronauts to make that moon landing. Did you think about that at all?
I think we all would like to. I don't think there's anyone that has any real red blood left in him wouldn't like to be on a flight like this, of course. But, you know, there are no regrets or anything like that. I'm just very happy, and I feel very fortunate that I was able to participate in the space program at all, and that, say I had been 10 years younger, maybe I wouldn't have been picked for the program at all. So I have no regrets, and it's just it's a tremendous experience, and of course, everyone that's had anything to do with the space program is envious of the fellows up there now. They couldn't help but be. I would love to be on the flight, as would everyone else, and all the engineers and technicians and everyone else that's been connected with the program. But this flight has gone to them, and they are doing just an outstanding job. And we're just very happy to be able to share this with people all over the world because all the people in the program really, really, truly look at it as a program that does represent, more represents mankind than just only a national program here. And we've looked at our program that way right from the early days. And so I know when I have had the opportunity to travel to many different countries and in my travels for the space program and in business, I've been in 34 countries in the last 3 years. And so I've had a chance to meet many, many different people. So I know from firsthand experience the interest that people all over the world have in this program. And one of the beautiful things about it is that there's nothing in it that is secret. We've been able to share this, and this the whole program up to now has really been that of really developing a transportation system and putting it all together and testing it over and over again in stages. And this flight, of course, is the one where the system finally is coming into its own. It's finally being used for the first time as a whole complete transportation system to go into space and really do things. And now we hope we can look forward to using it for many different scientific purposes and experiments and can make these things really flying laboratories so that we maximize the return of information from space. For that's really the purpose of the program is the research and the exploration that goes on that can benefit all mankind. And I think that the space race that gets talked about so much is really of very, very secondary importance. The main thing is that this is the beginning of a big flow of information and knowledge back that can be used by people all over the world, and we have no idea yet what the benefit of this may be. We're just at the starting point, just stepping off, and it's like exploring here on Earth, or it's like conducting research in a laboratory, but no one has any vision right now, really, of what value this will be as new things are discovered and new principles and new experiments. And so that's rather a long-winded speech I didn't really mean to get into here. I'll turn it back to you here for a second, but that's really the status of the program right now.
Well, I think it only illustrates vocally, Colonel Glenn, the fact that you haven't lost your enthusiasm, nor your interest, nor the vitality of your own being in the outer space program, whether it be American or whether it be an international type of program.
I think our man makes progress, if we could be a little philosophical here just for a second, man makes progress only by his own curiosity. And that's true whether it's in the space program or how to develop better teachers or doctors or librarians or farmers or whatever. Man makes his progress by being curious about the unknown and by learning new facts and by then putting them to use. And that's really the purpose of this program. Here we as a nation, for the first time, have been able to mount such a big program in exercising our curiosity about what is up above the atmosphere and what we can discover and how can we control weather here on Earth and how can we do Earth resources programs and what is on the moon and how do cosmic rays react up there above our atmosphere and just a million and one things that we're curious about. And this curiosity is really what all of man's progress is based on.
Well, Colonel Glenn, a number of scientists have suggested rather strenuously that for a period of time, the likelihood is, in their opinions, that man himself does not need to be, nor does he belong in space. How do you feel about this,
well,
man
I've
himself?
Well, I've never looked at the manned or the unmanned programs as being as competitive as most people seem to think they are. I've looked at them as being complementary. I think no matter how far man goes in space, he always will still be sending out probes and unmanned vehicles ahead of him, ahead of his own explorations, to find out what is there and to be as safe in his own explorations as possible. But I think man going into this new space, this new laboratory, if you will, to conduct his own research, can learn so much more. After all, man is the only, if you want to call him an instrument, he's the only instrument that can really perceive the new and analyze it on the spot and relate it to his own existence and his own back to his own Earth as to what is useful.
Well, there was a very good example of that when the lunar module was landed by astronaut Neil Armstrong.
Yes,
he had to make a decision in a matter of 1 minute where he was going to park his vehicle. And
had been just an unmanned landing there and come down in the rocks that he originally was making his approach on, why it probably would have had we don't know what might have happened.
Before we conclude this telephone conversation, Colonel Glenn, Perhaps you could make a bit of a quick comparison for us between the Mercury capsule in which you made your three orbits around the Earth and the type of equipment aboard Apollo 11. Could we make this comparison that your Mercury capsule was something like the Conestoga wagons which the American pioneers dragged across the western plains?
Yeah, I think you wouldn't be too far off on that one. Of course, the trying to compare two different spacecraft is a difficult thing because they're designed for different jobs. And each, of course, was on its own time was out on the cutting edge of science, or was out in the advance of what we knew how to do at that particular time. Of course, one thing leads to another. You know, it's like saying that compare one of the early automobiles and a modern Indianapolis racer or a huge truck. Now there just is no comparison because they're while they are sort of sisters or brothers under the skin, nevertheless they are. They're designed to do different things and designed with a different purpose. So each one of these things leads to another one, though. When Al Shepard made his suborbital flight, I build on his information for my flight, and subsequent flights after mine went into Gemini, and they build on my experience, and so on up the line. Back in those days, of course, the things that we were trying to discover were things such as could man even operate intelligently in this new area of space, in a weightless environment? And we were interested in such what look as though very elementary things now, but in that time we were interested in such things as whether the shape of the eyeball even changes in a weightless state over a number of hours, because the base of the eye then is no longer needed to support the fluid in the eye. So the doctors wondered whether the eyeball actually changed shape. So we had a number of just similar, very elementary questions about whether man could function in that new environment of space, and what his limitations were, what his capabilities were, and also how to design spacecraft to accommodate the man. And these were the things that we were trying to answer. Once we knew those problems, or knew the answers to those things, which we did determine in Mercury, then we could go on to Gemini, in which the major objectives were long-term weightlessness of periods up to 2 weeks, and also developing the rendezvous capability for spacecraft that was necessary before we could go on to designing something like this lunar vehicle that just landed on the moon today. So each project had its own purpose and a different purpose in its own time period. So it's difficult to just go back and say compare the Mercury spacecraft with this one, because there isn't. It's a difficult thing to do. Each had its own purpose, and each was in a different time period.
Colonel John Glenn, we want to thank you very much for this exclusive telephone interview which you've had, you and the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, and we here in Washington. We are most grateful.
VOA's Albert Johnson in a telephone conversation with Colonel Glenn, the first American to fly an orbital mission in outer space. 17 hours and 2 minutes, the lunar orbiter has been on the surface of the moon. A young Russian-born engineer named Eugene Zaitsev was responsible for supervising construction and testing of two major scientific packages which have been left on the moon by Apollo 11. The package is called ESEP, or Early Apollo Scientific Experiments Package. Rhett Turner talked with Zaitsev about it.
Gene Zaitsev, you spent quite a few years developing these experiment packages for the moon with the Bendix Corporation. What is this first one, ESAP, E-A-S-E-P? That's an acronym, isn't it?
That's right. It stands for Early Apollo Scientific Experiments Package. And to be precise, I spent 3 years working on it.
3 years?
That's right.
Okay, tell us about what's in ESAP. First of all, that passive seismic detector.
Right. ESAP consists really of two experiments, passive seismic experiment plus the necessary electronics for transmission of data to Earth. The purpose of it is to measure moonquakes and therefore determine if there's any activity, tectonic activity or seismic activity on the moon.
Lunar earthquakes.
Lunar earthquakes.
Do you think that we will find any sort of rumbling down under the surface? What do the scientists think?
It's pretty hard to determine. I personally hope we will, because it will make the moon so much more interesting to study.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably a 50-50 chance that we will.
And how big is this experiment? Would you describe what it looks like?
It's basically a cylindrical can made out of beryllium in which we have three sensors for long period quakes and one for short period quake. They're perpendicularly orthogonal to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It weighs approximately 10 kilograms plus additional 40 kilograms for the electronics that is necessary to transmit data to Earth.
Now, this is the experiment that has the solar panels which flop out like wings almost.
That's
right?
Correct. And because electronics needs power, it would require some power generation scheme. And for the ESAP, we decided to use solar cells.
And how much, you say, it weighs about 10 kilograms?
The passive experiment itself, it weighs about 10 kilograms. The total package with the solar panels and electronics, about 45 kilograms.
Now, this won't be very heavy for Buzz Aldrin or Neil to carry around on the moon.
No, of course, on the moon it'll be 1/6 that weight.
Uh-huh. And how long do you think the experiment will last on the surface there?
Well, it will be operational only during the lunar day because it requires sun to shine on solar cells. During the night, it will not work. We hope it will survive the night and the next lunar day will operate again. To guarantee this, we have included two thermal heaters using plutonium-238 to keep the electronics warm during the cold lunar night.
And what's the other scientific package to be left on the moon on Apollo 11?
The other one is a laser reflector. It's an array of optical cubes that will reflect the laser beam that could be shined at the moon from the Earth to measure exactly, very precisely, the distance between the transmitting station on the Earth and the laser reflector deployed on the moon.
I understand that this has some exciting implications. You're completing the geometric triangle, which could bring forth all sorts of triangulation experiments from the Earth because of the accuracy of light waves transmitting to a single point there. Is that right?
That's correct. And many, many things will be known after this experiment is in operation. Additionally, being a passive experiment in a sense that it does not require any electronics or heating, it will operate for years, 10 years at least, as anticipated. It will also can be used by any country. It can be used by anyone who is interested in making detailed measurements from the location where they're at to the moon.
All they have to do is shine a laser beam at the experiment.
Well, it's a little more involved than that. They'll have to have a pretty large-sized telescope to shine it through, about mm-hmm. 60 inches is
well, now,
minimum.
I understand that we can learn something of continental drift. The continents drifting apart, also ranging the distance from here to the moon with much greater accuracy.
That's right.
Other things.
The basic measurements is really the precise measurements of the distance from which we can calculate the center of the lunar mass, the center of the Earth mass, precisely the orbit of the moon around the Earth. Things like there are some theories that the gravity is actually decreasing with time.
That its moon is drifting away?
Then if the moon is drifting away very slowly, and that can be measured, then the theory is correct. The other theory, again not proven, is the continental drift, the fact that the South America and Africa were at one time together and are drifting apart. By making continuous measurements over many years, for both from the Africa and the South America continents,
mm-hmm.
we can determine if they're actually continuing to drift. It'll take quite a few years because the drift, anticipated drift, is a couple of centimeters per year. And with accuracy of the measurements of 15 centimeters, it'll take about 10 years to get the answer.
Thanks very much, Gene Zaitsev of the Bendix Corporation, for describing the Apollo experiments package to be left on the moon on Apollo 11.
We were discussing some of the experiments, and the question came up earlier in the program as to whether or not all of the experiments had been performed that had been assigned to the astronauts. Merle Waugh, our NASA expert, had expressed some doubt as to whether or not the auxiliary antenna for the TV camera had been deployed. We, at that time, did not know the answer. We understand that Jim Miller in Houston has the answer. We'll take you now to Houston and Jim Miller.
Yes, Stu, and the word from Mission Control, pardon me, is that the experimental TV antenna was not used because the transmission from the antenna mounted on the Eagle Lunar Module produced such excellent results that the experimental antenna was not necessary, and so it would have done just have been that much more work. And since they got such beautiful results from the lunar module antenna, they went with that, and of course we all know the results of that, particularly for the television transmission that was received here at Mission Control. Otherwise, on the experiments, I presume, Merle, that it's going to be months and months and months of accumulating material as it's fed back.
The one question might be on the passive seismic experiment, whether it does indeed survive the lunar night as planned with its auxiliary heating and so forth. But you're right, we have a lot to learn over the next few months from these experiments. I gather then that everything else, as far as you know down there, Jim, was successfully deployed and is now operational.
World. Yes, the understanding here is, I know the first announcement that we got in Houston of success was when the laser contact was made. It was announced by the Link Observatory out in California. And that came, it seems to me, within less than an hour after it was deployed.
So, I had not heard that even.
Yes, that was announced here, as I say, in the first of the experiments to be tried. Now, I noticed that on the solar wind experiment that when Buzz Aldrin, shortly before he went back into the lunar module, took down this apparatus, which appears to be, as was mentioned previously, something like a window shade that is made of metal foil. I was wondering how that will be determined. It was a short exposure, and I presume that material of this kind can be gathered rather quickly if it were only out there something like 2 hours.
Well, it's of course, a collector of solar energy, and depending on the surface of this particular sheet of the experiment will have to be analyzed when it comes back to find out what type of penetrations were made and so forth. There's nothing they can see at this time, Jim, so I think we'll have to wait till he brings that back for analysis.
Merle, would there be any problem in preserving the information? In other words, in the storing of this sheet of foil, bringing it back to Earth, what's the calculated risk there?
I don't believe that... I believe this is a sort of a mechanical deformation of the material, and I don't think it'll change during that time. And of course, on the other experiment, we're apparently getting information back, and have been ever since it was deployed. This passive seismic experiment was apparently working right from the start, and some of its short period data was or capability was recording the astronauts' motions and thumpings of the Earth during the first few minutes they were on the they had it out on the surface.
Here in Houston, on Monday night, of course, the three astronauts all have homes here, and their wives all were around in their individual homes watching the events unfold on the surface of the moon. And Buzz Aldrin's wife, Joan, said that she just couldn't believe it. It was more than the human mind can comprehend.
Jim, I'm going to have to interrupt you. You're listening to the Voice of America's continuing coverage of the Apollo mission. This program is originating in Washington. We will return to our live Voice of America coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
Apollo 11 astronauts Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins are resting at this hour. Aboard the landing craft Eagle, parked on the surface of the moon in the Sea of Tranquility, Armstrong is reported dozing. Aboard the command ship Columbia, which continues in lunar orbit, crewman Michael Collins is sleeping soundly. In about 4.5 hours, astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin will fire the ascent engine and take off for a link-up with Columbia. The three crewmen are to reunite in the command ship, set course for home, and splash down Thursday in the mid-Pacific. In the Mideast, Egypt reported heavy exchanges of fire near the city of Suez this morning. The shooting follows yesterday's six-hour battle between Egyptian and Israeli forces involving air, ground, and amphibious action along the Suez Canal. The cabinet of South Vietnamese Premier Tran Van Hung has submitted its resignation. The move is designed to facilitate the setting up of a new administration. In military action, South Vietnamese forces reported several scattered engagements. United States authorities in Saigon reported only one significant ground action yesterday, an infantry clash near Hue. Briefly, this news from the United States. The White House says President Nixon will outline a new domestic welfare program when he returns from his round-the-world trip. National Guardsmen were withdrawn from Youngstown, Ohio, yesterday. The town has returned to normal after last week's racial clashes. But disorders continued for the fourth night at York, Pennsylvania. The United States Senate tomorrow resumes debate on the controversial Safeguard anti-ballistic missile proposal. A vote is expected late this week. Former United States Vice President Hubert Humphrey, on a private tour, met with Soviet Premier Alexei Kosygin in Moscow. Mr. Humphrey said the Soviet leader told him the Soviet government is looking forward to working with the United States in the search for peace. That's the news from the Voice of America newsroom. This is Bob White reporting.
You're listening to the Voice of America's continuing coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. Immediately prior to our newscast, VOA reporter Jim Miller in Houston was giving us some observations on the reactions of the wives of the three astronauts. We're going to ask Jim to resume his description of the wives' reactions.
Thank you, Stu. Mrs. Aldrin, Joan Aldrin, I was commenting on just for the news there, said that she had cried after the events took place on the moon, but she said that she would assure everyone that these were tears of happiness. And at her home, Pat Collins, who is the wife of Mike Collins, who is now asleep up there in Columbia, circling around the moon, said it was positively marvelous and that they sounded a lot calmer than she did. She said she was very excited, but from what she could tell, that everything went just like clockwork. And over at Neil Armstrong's home, his wife and children were watching on television, and Jan Armstrong said that she was terribly excited, and she thought that it was absolutely marvelous that they landed successfully. And she was following the course of the last few critical moments of the landing on the moon with astronaut Bill Anders, whom you will remember was a member of the Apollo 8 crew, which first circled the moon back in December. And she followed the map all the way right up until the touchdown. And she was asked if Neil's walk on the moon was the greatest moment in her life, and she quickly denied that. She said the greatest moment in her life was when she married Neil Armstrong. And now back to you in Washington.
Jim?
Yeah.
Speaking of tears coming to people's eyes, I was happened to be watching Wally Schirra during the time that of the touchdown, and when he finally realized it had happened, he was speechless for a few moments, and then he had to wipe a tear or two from his eyes too. So I think it affected everybody pretty heavily.
I think there is just no doubt about it. I was watching television in the auditorium here at NASA at the manned space spacecraft headquarters. And the room was filled with newsmen from literally all over the world. As you know, there are almost 4,000 news people here covering this. And as soon as Neil Armstrong said, "The hatch is open," there was spontaneous applause. And this happened several more times throughout the night. There was just a feeling of elation that just sort of unified everybody in that auditorium.
Speaking of reaction, there's more reaction from Europe to the moonwalk of the Apollo 11 crew. And Bill Winchester has this report from Bonn, where he says people have braved the early dawn hours to watch the event on television.
Television pictures beamed here by satellite were extraordinarily sharp, and it's believed an unprecedented number of Germans viewed the coverage through early Monday morning. Shops reported a record demand for rental television sets. Theaters, cinemas, and operas reported the lowest attendance in memory for a Sunday evening. Police said in many cities, automobile traffic was far below normal volume as Germans by the millions decided to spend this Sunday evening in their own living rooms before their television sets. On the official side, Chancellor Kurt-Georg Kiesinger has sent a congratulatory telegram to President Nixon. I have watched with rapt attention and admiration the flight of Apollo 11 and the historic landing of the first man on the moon, the Chancellor told Mr. Nixon. He added, I express to you, Mr. President, to the three daring astronauts, and to our friends, the American people, my hearty congratulations for this sensational deed, which represents one of the greatest and most memorable events in the history of mankind. These the words of West German Chancellor Kiesinger to President Nixon. The chief press spokesman here in Bonn, Mr. Günther Diehl, expressed congratulations in the name of the federal government, saying the landing signaled a new epoch for mankind, and that the entire German people followed the event with admiration and best wishes for the safe return of the astronauts. Foreign Minister Willy Brandt echoed these words and added, we have followed on our television screens a truly epic-making event. We congratulate the President and people of the United States and all who contributed to the space trip. But above all, we wish the first moon travelers further success and a safe return to our good Earth. This is Bill Winchester, Voice of America, Bonn.
And now from London, Norman Gelb reporting.
Queen Elizabeth has sent a message to the United States voicing her admiration for the fortitude of the astronauts who walked on the moon. The Queen offered her good wishes and prayers for their safe return to Earth. London looked a little groggy Monday morning. Many people here stayed up late, some until the dawn's early light, to see on their television sets man taking his first steps on solid ground beyond the Earth's atmosphere. The London Times said Monday morning it was difficult to tell yet the significance of man on the moon, but it said the achievement of the American astronauts will always be one of the wonders of the world. The newspaper The Guardian says no other great adventure was as great as this. The London Daily Mail said, whatever happens, we shall not stop now. It is the measure of man's restless spirit, the Daily Mail said, and of his greatness, that he should take on the universe. Norman Gelb reporting from London.
And the people of Singapore followed the progress of the Apollo 11 mission closely, as we hear now from the Voice of America's Keith Lorenz.
Although the Apollo 11 landed at 3:48 a.m. Singapore time Monday, when most Singaporeans were asleep, the enthusiastic reaction during the morning, culminating with the lunar walk, has come from citizens of all races. With television coverage still to come, radio listeners have followed the astronauts' progress with reports in Chinese, English, Malay, and Tamil. Newspapers have given entire front pages to last-minute stories from Washington and the Houston Space Center. The enthusiastic reaction of Singapore, composed of many cultural streams, is indicative of a forward-looking population where progress in this small island depends on teamwork, initiative, and faith, as did the arduous space conquest resulting in Monday's historic lunar touchdown. The excited babble of Singaporeans in many tongues discussing the significance of the moon landing can be observed along the famous city landmarks, the bustling ports, and the quiet villages of the Republic. In a time of political uncertainty in Southeast Asia, Singaporeans are hoping that the successful moon landing may lessen certain power struggles which threaten the security of small nations in the area. For Singapore, the Apollo 11's real mission will be more understanding and common sense in Asia for the benefit of all nations to live and trade in harmony. Keith Lorenz, Voice of America, Singapore.
The Apollo lunar spacecraft, the lunar module, has been on the surface of the moon now some 17 hours, 24 minutes. And congratulations continue to pour into Washington and, of course, to Houston. And added to other congratulations were the words of Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos. Mr. Marcos hailed the achievement of the Eagles' touchdown earlier today. In just a moment, we'll have that report from the Voice of America's Jim Alves.
In a message soon after astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin completed the moon exploration, President Marcos said, "The Filipino people join the world in congratulating the United States for putting the first men on the moon." President Marcos called the moonwalk a triumphant milestone in the conquest of space, which augurs a greater achievement in the broadening of man's vision. He added, "The feat furthers the fulfillment of a larger destiny within the framework of a true human brotherhood and an enduring peace." The lunar exploration occurred noontime Monday in the Philippines and was broadcast by several television and radio networks. The broadcast was relayed to the Philippines via satellite. In Manila, huge crowds gathered in several public places where television networks and appliance companies have placed large screen television sets. Pedestrian traffic was halted for several hours in an underpass in Manila's central commercial district as people watched the telecast on television sets in display windows. One appliance store was stormed by an angry crowd when it turned off its set. The store owner was forced to turn it on again. The crowds broke into an applause as the two Apollo 11 astronauts planted the American flag on the moon. Major Philippine newspapers came out with extra editions Monday afternoon, headlining the moonwalk. This is Jim Alves, Voice of America, Manila.
We've been discussing at great length in this particular portion of the program and the one immediately prior to the newscast at the half hour, the experiments being conducted by the men on the moon. These experiments obviously lead to future events, and I'm going to ask Merle Waugh now to tell us what NASA has in the mill after Apollo 11.
The experiments on this mission represent a very few number of many experiments that have been proposed for this mission and for the later missions in the program. It was decided early in this particular program to not burden the astronauts when they were doing their basic pioneering job, and so therefore this basic early Apollo scientific package has only a restricted number of experiments. After this flight, though, with the confidence we have that the landings can be made, experiment program will be expanded. The program that NASA has following Apollo, the Apollo Applications Program, is a program where its primary mission is to conduct a broad number of scientific experiments of all types. And frankly, as we have gone through this launch and the various dignitaries are interviewed, I'm listening for their comments, because they are the men that will make the decisions about what the programs will be in the future. And we're getting hints. For example, Vice President Agnew was talking about a Mars mission, and Dr. Siemens, the Secretary of the Air Force, was talking about the Apollo Applications Program and so forth. And what we do after this particular job is done will be a national decision made by these officials that we are hearing on television today, as they observe and are asked questions about this mission today.
Do I understand by that, then, that to a certain extent, commitments to, we'll say, Apollo 12 and Apollo 13 are at the moment tentative?
Those missions are firmly planned. The only reason we might want to change from our plan is whatever results we've gotten from this mission. So I would say those missions are firmly planned. There may be some reasons come up from evaluation of this data where you might want to change those plans slightly. But I would say that those are our firm plans. I was thinking of the many things we have proposed within NASA for the future, and what decisions might be made to accept and authorize us to continue on these new programs.
I see. Assuming then that Apollo 12 is firmly planned, can you give us an idea of the schedule, the projected dates for launch, and the purpose of Apollo 12?
Well, I only know the schedule roughly, but I know it's scheduled before this year is out, and it will be to continue the rather simple form of lunar exploration that we've started here in Apollo 11, where the men actually walk on the surface, deploy instrumentation, bring back samples, and so forth.
The lunar module has now been on the surface of the moon some 17 hours and 30 minutes. And congratulations continue to pour in, have now come from the Soviet Union. For a report, here is the Voice of America's David Lent.
The first high-level Soviet message of congratulations for the Apollo success came from Communist Party leader Leonid Brezhnev in Warsaw to attend the celebrations of the 25th anniversary of the communist regime in Poland. He paused before the American ambassador at a reception of foreign diplomats at Warsaw Airport. Speaking in Russian, Mr. Brezhnev told Ambassador Walter Stoessel, "I wish you success." A top Soviet space scientist was more explicit. The chairman of the Soviet Commission for the Promotion of Interplanetary Flight, Leonid Sedov, praised the landing and moonwalk as a great scientific achievement and one of tremendous social significance, which, he said, will develop scientific cooperation and strengthen peace. Mr. Sedov said he hopes for greater Soviet-American cooperation in space, but that, he said, depends on the general international situation. And he added, "We hope that cooperation in space, in turn, will help improve the international climate." Another Soviet scientist, Konstantin Porshevsky, could hardly contain his enthusiasm after witnessing film of the moonwalk. Like the first cosmonaut, Yuri Gagarin, he declared, "Astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin have written a glorious page in the history of the cosmos." Mr. Borshevsky, who is vice director of the Moscow Planetarium, admitted that "what I saw excited me very much," and he declared that the lunar objects collected by the astronauts will give science invaluable results on the further exploration of the moon. East European press comment has also been exceedingly enthusiastic in its praise of the Apollo mission. The Polish Communist Party newspaper Trybuna Ludu, for example, declared that the landing of Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin on the moon can only be compared with the triumph of Columbus. And the Polish newspaper continued, "May our thoughts, the thoughts of 3,000 million inhabitants of the earth, help them and contribute to their strength in performing the other, no less difficult stage of the task, the return to the home planet." A similar theme was heard on Radio Bratislava. The Slovak radio station said, "We are keeping our fingers crossed for the astronauts and wish them a happy return to Earth." Radio Prague reported that the Czechoslovak press gave heavy and enthusiastic play to the Apollo story. The trade union newspaper Pravda, for example, headlined its story, "A Historical Effort of Mankind." The Romanian Communist Party newspaper Sintea was equally lavish in its praise. "The moon landing," it declared, "is undoubtedly one of the most extraordinary events in the whole history of mankind." The first words spoken by man from the moon, Sintea continued, "have aroused a tremendous wave of enthusiasm in the whole world." Apollo coverage in Soviet media was markedly more restrained. Soviet television was joined only by Bulgarian television in East Europe in failing to provide coverage during the moon walk. Instead, Soviet television provided a 7-minute package of film after the walk had ended. Radio Sofia also provided restrained coverage,
while giving prominent play to an interview stressing that unmanned space flights are cheaper and safer. Considerably more enthusiastic was the driver of a Sofia streetcar. "Good for Armstrong," he is reported to have said. "Tell him I'll give him a free ride on my streetcar if he comes to Bulgaria." David Lent, Voice of America, European Bureau.
With a look at Israeli comment on the Apollo 11 achievement, here's VOA's Charles Lord in Jerusalem.
Israel awoke this morning to headlines of a man on the moon and of full-scale warfare along the Suez Canal. The two stories competed for precedence, with the moon mission winning out in the majority of cases. Probably the most significant editorial comment on the moon mission came from the independent daily Haaretz. It noted the coincidence of the voyages of Apollo 11 and the mysterious Luna 15, and concluded that Israel really has no interest in the outcome of the contest between the United States and the Soviet Union, but only in the scientific achievement as such. The Haaretz editorial then goes on to add, "Our hearts, however, are with the American mission in the hope it will be crowned with success. All our upbringing, everything we have been taught, puts us on the side of those who do what they do out in the open." The English language Jerusalem Post, wishing the astronauts a safe return, defends the Apollo mission against criticism that it is a waste of resources that might be put to better use, combating ignorance and poverty. The Daily points out that the greatest part of the money spent has gone to subsidize basic and technical research and to create new techniques and advanced materials that may well create a new and greater American wealth in the next decade. The chief rabbi of Israel and spiritual leader of the country's Sephardi community, Rabbi Yitzhak Nissim, said that the mission's success must of necessity strengthen man's sense of awe before his creator. "But putting a man on the moon will prove to have been worthwhile," he went on, "only if it teaches mankind humility, if it opens a new chapter in civilization in which man will seek to walk in the way of the Lord and put off pettiness in his dealings with his fellow men." This is Charles Lord, Voice of America in Jerusalem.
Apollo 11 is affecting more than the emotions of people around the world. Business in certain areas has been affected by the flight. In Washington, D.C., people who rent television sets say that they've long since been all sold or rented out, we should say, as interested Americans made sure that they would see the first step on the moon. In Japan, the flight and the moon landing has been accompanied by a large jump in the sales of color television, as we hear now in this report from VOA's Walter Sheldon in Tokyo.
Production of color television sets is up 78.6% in Japan for the first half of 1969, and the sets are being snapped up everywhere, in the cities and even in remote villages. Figures on TV color set production have just been released by the Electronic Industries Association of Japan. Monthly production in June, the association reports, topped the 400,000 mark. This is higher than any previous monthly production figure. The huge jump in production and sales is attributed largely to a campaign by the television industry in Japan that employed the slogan, "See Apollo 11 in color." All major manufacturers of color television sets joined in publicity drives based upon this theme in the several weeks before the launching of Apollo 11. The Apollo 11 moonshot also coincides with summer bonus time in Japan, when most Japanese workers receive lump sums of money as part of their customary, although not obligatory, wages. Since the outset of the Apollo 11 flight, many neighborhood stores are out of stock when it comes to color television sets, and retailers have been bombarding distributors with frantic requests for more. Part of the desire to watch Apollo 11 in color springs from the broadcasts received in Japan via Intelsat during the Apollo 10 mission. The boom in color TV sets in Japan is all the more remarkable when their cost is considered. Some smaller, less elaborate sets sell for about $300, but the average useful color set costs about $400. Under Japan's present wage scales, this is a rather high monthly salary for a reasonably high-ranking office worker in a big city. Many families who buy color television sets in Japan, especially in the rural areas, probably get along on about half the price of such a set each month. On the other hand, the people of Japan are generally prosperous, and a family's regular fixed income is not always the exact measure of its economic level. Benefits such as bonuses twice a year and group entertainment provided by companies enter into the picture. Japan's first big leap in television viewing came about 10 years ago when the sale of black and white sets was stimulated by the wedding of the Crown Prince and the Crown Princess. The Tokyo Olympic Games of 1964 gave color television its first boost. Now the flight of Apollo 11 is apparently turning the previous luxury of color television into something approaching a necessity. At least, that's how many Japanese regard it. Walter Sheldon, Voice of America, Tokyo.
The lunar module has been on the surface of the moon now some 17 hours and 40 minutes. And in the remaining minutes of this particular segment of our broadcast, we're going to ask Merle Waugh to give us a sort of a status report on the two astronauts in the lunar module, whether or not they're awake, and if they are, what is their schedule from now until blastoff?
Stu, I believe they're scheduled to sleep a little bit longer. And then prior to the time they are going to blast off to rejoin the command module, they're going to have to eat and then check out their systems and so forth to be sure everything's ready to go. So I would say they probably ought to sleep for another hour before we hear anything from them.
I understand that they dispensed with some material to lighten their weight for blast off. Could you tell us what the things were that were not left on the moon as experiments, but as, I suppose we should say, waste?
Let's see. They had to get rid of most of the equipment that was uniquely for the time they were out on the lunar surface. They left their TV camera. They left all their little hand tools and equipment, such as that, and then. After getting into the spacecraft, they, of course, left a lot of their personal gear, such as extravehicular suits and so forth.
Thank you, Merle. We're going to remind our listeners in the Far East now, who may be tuned to 9735 kilocycles, to tune to 9740. In the Middle East, who are tuned to 11.960, to tune to 15270. And in Africa, who are tuned to 5965, to tune to 21695 kilocycles. This is the Voice of America's continuing coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. This program is originating in Washington.